But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, the Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Schodel, and I'm here with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Hey, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. Great to be sitting in front of you again.
Top of the morning to you, as they say, right? It's
yes.
Patty's Day
yes.
today. Yeah, I'm sorry about my absence last week. I just had so much stuff going on. I couldn't get into the studio. And I guess they ran the show with the grandkids,
show.
Right? Yeah, so hopefully everybody had a laugh with that and a good time. So we're back and better than ever, and here we are on St. Patty's Day. And, you know, wishing all our friends out there a happy St. Patty's Day if you're Irish. If you're not, happy St. Patty's Day. It doesn't matter, you know.
All is good. All is good. I guess it's kind of late to give tips on how to cook your corned beef because I guess by 9 o'clock Sunday morning of St. Patrick's Day, people probably have already cooked it.
There's not a lot of tips to be had, you know? I mean, you put it in water, you boil it, and you wait. You know,
well, what really about this Guinness and this and that?
Yeah, you can tart it up that way, you know, pickling spice and beer or whatever. But it's, you know, excuse me, it's kind of funny. You know, I do a buffet at the club every year, you know, with St. Patty's Day, and we're always looking for, you know, Irish, you know, inflected menus and things. And as much research as I've done on this stuff over the years, they really don't have an awful lot of, you know, like, different ethnically Irish dishes. You know, corned beef, I guess, is, you know, a Patty's Day thing. And then you have like a shepherd's pie, a lamb stew. That's kind of Irish. Salmon is definitely Irish. Cold cannon, you know, cabbage and potatoes. After that, it kind of runs short. I mean, if there's people out there in the audience who know differently, please, you know, email us and let us know. But for the most part, it's kind of the short list. You know, it's really kind of funny because when I, you know, my family's background is England, and, you know, when you think of fine English cuisine cookbooks, there's probably, you know, one out there somewhere. But over the last 20 years, it's all changed. And, you know, you have some really high-end restaurants in London and in Ireland now. You have Michelin star restaurants and stuff. So there's, you know, been a whole food revolution over in the British Isles. And it's nice to see, you know. There's some very talented Irish chefs doing great work over there, and same goes for England. And but, you know, their product list, you know, I mean, vegetables they have, you know, coming out of their ears. But when it comes down to, you know, fish and meat, and they kind of rely, it seems, on the same sort of things, you know. And so anyway, I think that if you're going to do an Irish menu for tonight, and, you know, if you're going to go out or whatever, you know, corned beef to me is kind of an anomaly because it's basically brisket that's been messed around with, you know, pickling salts and stuff like that, and to get it to that pink color.
You don't put cloves in it or anything?
No, pickling spice is not cloves in it. It's a little strong, you know. There's all kinds of, you know, there's bay leaf in there and you know, coriander, and there's a mess of things in the pickling spice. But, you know, for the most part, it's manipulated meat, you know. I don't really eat a lot of corned beef, and I don't think people do either. You know, it's kind of it's sort of like a Jewish deli thing now. You know, I have a friend who owns a deli out in Amagansett, and he doesn't even buy corned beef anymore because nobody eats it. And the only place I really see it is in places like Pastrami King or Ben's or whatever, where you have that. It has you know, sort of an ethnic connection, you know, to the Jewish community. I mean, corned beef sandwiches and Reubens and stuff like that, you know, came out of the Lower East Side, I believe. And they're fun to eat, you know. But for me, it's mood food. I'd rather have pastrami because I like the taste
That's
better.
That's so funny you say that. So in my family, I think my mother and I used to get corned beef sandwiches. Again, corned beef on a sandwich during 12 months out of the year is Jewish soul food.
Yeah.
So Sunday nights, sometimes we'd have deli.
Right.
And we'd go to an Oceanside. There was a local kosher deli called H&I. And I'd go there with my dad, and we'd get a half a pound of this. Anything from bologna, white salami, because it was the bigger slices.
Big one, yeah.
Maybe roast beef. I'm not sure if we ever got brisket, but we'd get tongue, corned beef and pastrami or whatever, and then we get club bread. So a lot of people get sandwiches on rye bread, but club bread made it a little special. We get some coleslaw, some potato salad,
sure, yeah,
some Russian dressing. Always there was deli mustard,
yeah.
Then there would be the sodas. I can't think of the name of it.
Dr. Brown's. Yeah.
And because I was always watching my beautiful figure.
The celery
it
soda.
It would be the celery tonic, but the diet, which they stopped making. Now they only make that in the regular, if they still make it.
I'm a sucker for Diet Black Cherry, Dr. Brown's.
Yeah,
Love it.
It's classic.
Yeah.
But again, used to love to do that. But and I would be the guy that would put the sliced corned beef. And again, when you get the corned beef at a deli like that, it's usually sliced thin.
Yeah.
As compared, if you go into the city, like the Smith's Bar and Grill or whatever,
uh-huh,
they'd be hand-cutting it, and you get it a quarter-inch slice
like
of corned beef or whatever. But I on my sandwich, I would always do some coleslaw, mustard. I'd actually put some Russian dressing on there. But it was always corned beef.
Yeah.
And then the other day, I came to an epiphany that there was nothing there. And I went with the pastrami, and it wasn't as dry. It was definitely, I guess, fattier. But I try to get it, I asked for it lean or whatever. But I just decided that the pastrami had a little more.
It does. It has much more flavor.
Pop to it.
Yeah. I mean, about once every 2 months, I get this wiggy for Jewish soul food, you know, and I go wandering into Ben's like Dawn of the Dead, you know. And it's always the same thing for me. I'm the most boring customer they have. I have a bowl of mushroom barley soup and or, it depends, you know, sometimes bowl of mushroom barley soup and then a half a pastrami sandwich. And I can't eat anymore. It's just too much. Or I'll have a half a pastrami sandwich and kasha varnishkas, which is my all-time favorite. And most people don't realize it. It's so good for you. That's buckwheat groats, you know, kasha. It's my favorite grain. It's got more flavor than rice or barley or any of them, you know.
When you eat the kasha, though, do you put gravy on it?
You got to make it slide, yeah. It's you got to moisten it up a little bit. Otherwise, it's kind of boring. But, the kasha with the gravy is fabulous, you know. And it's always the pastrami for me. I mean, you know, corned beef to me, again, it's kind of manipulated a little bit chemically. And it bothers me a little bit, you know. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s, so chemicals don't really scare me. But, you know, the bottom line is there's something about, I don't know, pink meat that I'm just not really all that fond of. But, you know, getting back to the whole Irish part of it, I guess it's some kind of a, you know, tradition. And I don't know, I honestly don't know. Is it a tradition in Ireland? Is corned beef a big thing in Ireland? Or is that just an American? It's like Parmesan, chicken Parmesan is like an American thing, you know. It's not really an Italian thing. So I'm not really sure. I've never been to Ireland. So
I'm not sure. I just have to make one comment. So I won't name the restaurant because it's not fair. But
here it comes.
My go-to Jewish soul food deli.
Yeah.
Was Pastrami King in South Merrick.
Yeah.
On Merrick Road just by the Meadowbrook. And they closed in July. And it's one of those stories that you talk about with restaurants and landlords and whatever.
Yeah, sure.
But at any rate, they closed in July. Nothing's in that building yet. Ben does a great job. I just thought that Pastrami King was a little more, in my mind, home cooking. They did a little extra effort on curing the pastrami and the corned beef or whatever. I felt like it was Cheers because when I walked in there, everybody knew my name and everything.
Totally.
That was at Pastrami King. Ben's gets it done. There's no question when you talk about their mushroom and barley soup and stuff like that. Even today when the Jewish holidays come, Passover or the High Holy Days in September, I go to Ben's to get my stuff. I have to get some of the sweet peppers and sour tomatoes. You know,
what's
a pickle tray
past,
or whatever.
You know?
But I went somewhere else the other day for pastrami sandwiches. And a pastrami sandwich or a deli sandwich from one of these places used to be like 3 inches high.
Yeah.
I was flabbergasted. It probably was the same price. However, it was it just wasn't as big as it used to be. And again, it wasn't Ben's, so don't misinterpret. But that was in my head, and I was reading an article the other day, and there's this new term, shrinkflation.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's in the supermarket. Like, if you go to get a bag of potato chips, it's all air.
Yeah.
It's same size bag. It's just filled with air.
Yeah.
So the prices stay the same by reducing the size of the portion.
Sure.
And again, I bet you, I'd put a hefty bet on the table with you that if you went to Ben's and bought a pastrami sandwich, that was for a half a sandwich that you would eat, and you take the other half home.
Yeah.
And it probably still is like that at Ben's. At this other place, no way.
Yeah, Ben's is still, you know, you almost have to unlock your jaw to get, you know, the sandwich in. You know, it's I wind up taking some of the meat off, you know, if I'm going to eat the sandwich.
And I like to say, I can say this because I'm of Jewish descent, but, you know, where can you go wrong when you go to Ben's and you get a bowl of free pickles and sauerkraut or coleslaw?
It's true. It's really kind of funny how that's, it's really kind of an ethnic thing. I was talking to somebody about country clubs the other day. Don, who is the manager, and great guy too, manager of the Mill River Club. And he was telling me he was working in Palm Beach Country Club, which is primarily Jewish. And he used to call her a pickle pusher. And she was this woman who used to just, they had a cart. And he used to go around with the cart. They had, you know, five different types of pickles, half sour, quarter sour, eighth sour, whatever, real sour, oh my God sour. And then they had, you know, coleslaw, washed coleslaw, regular coleslaw.
Here they got a couple of places. One is called Pickle Pete's, which is over in Hicksville.
Uh-huh.
Where you go in there and they got anything from pickles, sauerkraut, peppers, olives.
Mm-hmm.
And they also do a lot of the festivals.
And a
lot of the festivals today, they sell pickles on a stick.
Really? Yeah, I love a good pickle here and there, you know, but it's one of those things. It's got to be accompanied by a sandwich in my
right. But in today's world, everything, you know, in the old days, I probably, my memory isn't as sharp as it should be. But when you went into the pizza parlor, it was a plain pie and it was a pepperoni pie and maybe that was it. Same thing in the pickle world. You used to go, there was dill and sour or whatever.
Yeah,
there's wasabi and this. And
well, I mean, people's imaginations have really evolved, you know, as far as food goes, you know. I mean, I remember my grandmother in her era. I mean, everything was roasted on Sunday, this, that, and the other thing. I mean, now
and pickles are trendy today. We've had a restaurateur, I guess it was the down the rabbit hole. They have a martini that's not a dirty martini. It's a pickled
pickle
martini.
Juice. I use pickle juice to marinate chicken thighs in for sandwiches, believe it or not. So, you know, and two reasons. One, you know, you got the juice there. It's got a lot of flavor in it. Why throw it out, you know? And two is it adds a real punch to, you know, the sandwich.
So here we are talking about corned beef and St. Patrick's Day, and I brought it to the Jewish deli. You were about to talk about traditions in Ireland.
There are a lot of Jews in Ireland? I don't even know. I don't think they migrated there, you know? Yeah, I don't know too much about Ireland other than the fact that a friend of mine was there and he said it's one of the most beautiful countries he's ever been in, you know. You know, the Green Isle and all of that stuff, you know, it's all true. I had a very good friend who worked for me for a long time. His name was Jerry Smythe, and sadly he passed away very young. He had cancer. He was like in his 40s. Maniac. He was a typical cartoon Irish guy, you know, spent most of his life chasing surf around the world. He would work with me in Montauk in the summer, and in the winter he'd go to Australia to surf and, you know, surf all day, drink all night. He was just a party waiting to happen. But believe it or not, I had both of Albert Reynolds' daughters working for me in Montauk. You know who Albert Reynolds was?
No.
He was the prime minister of Ireland. Now, this is the equivalent of Chelsea Clinton working as a bus girl somewhere. You think it would happen in the United States? I don't think Chelsea would take a job as a bus girl. But these two girls, they came over because the Gossman family in Montauk used to bring a lot of the Irish kids over to work. You know, they were at H-2Bs or whatever.
Yeah, even in Freeport it was like that if you went to the restaurant.
Yeah, nicest kids, too. I mean, and you could tell them right away because they didn't use sunblock. They come over here, lay on the beach, and they'd all be glowing pink the next day, you know. But they were great kids. They were a lot of fun, just partying, carrying on, you know, just celebrating youth. And just the nicest attitude. I couldn't schedule them before 2 in the afternoon because they couldn't get up. You know, they couldn't work a lunch shift because they were out all night, you know. But that all changed because the Irish economy got better, you know. They used to come over here because there was no work really in Ireland. But now it's all changed. So you don't see him as much anymore. But I always marvel at the fact that, you know, Albert Reynolds would let his daughters, you know, or maybe even push his daughters in to go get a job somewhere when, you know, he was a fairly wealthy guy, I'm sure, you know. They could have stayed home, but he didn't. So hats off to them, you know. And all the Irish kids that I said, I'll tell you a funny story. I got to tell you this story. And maybe the FCC will throw me off the air for this, but...
Thanks.
Yeah, I had, you know, I used to play in a band, still do occasionally, but back in the late 80s, early 90s, I was playing a lot on the docks in Montauk, right? And the docks were crazy places in the summer. You know, all the kids would come, and, you know, we had a pretty big following. And I had this kid, Seamus, who used to work for me. And Seamus was maybe about 5'2 and about 112 pounds. Just a wrecking ball of a kid when he was, you know, working. He was a hard worker. He was a lot of fun to be around. But after three or four Guinnesses, he turned into this 6'5", 350-pound terrorist that was just a pain in the rear end to deal with, right? So... anyway, one night, Seamus comes down to hear the band, and I guess Seamus had one too many, and he's torturing the bouncer. Now, the bouncer was a friend of mine, Freddie, and Freddie was from the island of Trinidad, and Freddie looked like one of those guys that's carved out of the men's magazines. You know, he had a bicep and with a vein coming down it that was thicker than my ankle. You know, he was about 240 pounds with a waist about 28 inches. You know, he just looked like he was carved out of marble. 6'3", just this massive... unbelievably well-built human being and the nicest guy you could ever, you know, he wouldn't hurt a soul, right? So Freddie comes over to me. He goes, "Shuffle, I got me a problem, man. This guy, Seamus, I know he worked for you, man, but he's being a pain in my, you know what, I can't take him anymore. I'm going to have to." I said, "Well, just, you know, just tell him to behave. He'll be all right. You know, just tell him I said to behave, right?" "Okay, Shuffle, but I may have to toss him out of here." I said, "Okay." Anyway, he goes over and he explains to him. He says, "Listen, you know, you got to behave." Yeah, so Seamus goes, "Well, don't worry, Fred. I'll be all right. Don't worry, you know." Anyway, so Freddie comes back about a half an hour later. Shuffle, he break dancing with this girl in the middle of the floor. He's trying to make everybody drunk. He's buying drinks for everybody. He's torturing the whole place, right? I said, "All right, Fred, if you got to throw him out, throw him out. But, you know, just be kind. I mean, you know, whatever." So Freddie, "Yeah, okay." So he goes up. He goes, "Okay, Seamus, here's the deal. First of all, I can't take it no more, man. I can't take it. You have to go home. You're too drunk to be here." I said, "It's against the law to serve you anymore. You have to go." He says, "Not saying you can't come back, but man, you have to go home tonight." So Seamus looks at Freddie, goes, "I can see this like it was yesterday. All right then, Fred, I'll be leaving, but you can kiss me arse on the way out." Freddie's looking at me. I'm looking at Freddie. I'm like, "I don't know, Fred. I don't know what to say about that, you know." Freddie just shakes his head, walks away, you know. Hilarious. It reminded me that it was this poster in the 60s when I was a kid. And they had this hawk coming down at this mouse, you know, with his talons out, the whole thing. And the mouse is giving him the finger, you know, kind of. It kind of seemed the same way. This little diminutive little guy, you know, screaming at this, you know, 6'4" behemoth of a man, you know. Too funny.
You're always full of good stories.
But that's the Irish spirit, you know. Yeah, maybe I'll, you know, I should write a book.
Wow, that's a fresh story.
Yeah, I think I'm going to write a book. But, I, you know, I have a, I don't know if I ever told you a story, but I have this. I probably shouldn't put it out there because I think it's a pretty good idea. Somebody will jump on it. But I have this idea to write a novel, right? And what do I know about novel writing? I'm going to have to go on the internet and see how to set up a, you know, a book. But I have this idea, and it's based on a friend of mine who was a maniac chef. I mean, his name is Richard. I won't tell you his last name. It doesn't matter. And he's probably one of the most talented cooks I ever met. I mean, his food is brilliant. You know, he's just a great chef. But he's nuts. You know, he's completely nuts. He's from England. He makes Gordon Ramsay look stable, you know, at times. And so he's having trouble getting people to work with him because he's such a perfectionist that, you know, he can't tolerate anybody who's not as passionate as he is, who's not as particular, who's not as driven, who's not as whatever, you know. And we talked about this all the time. And he just can't abide that stuff. So anyway, I have this idea to combine his personality into a central character, combined with all my crazy restaurant stories about people who are nuts. And so the premise of the book is you know, he's in this high-end, you know, Le Bernardin kind of restaurant, and this lady sends back her fish or whatever and says it sucks. And he comes out and he gets into this repartee with this woman and finally just takes the plate and bashes her over the head with it, right, and winds up in jail. And then he turns... He winds up taking over the kitchen in the jail and turning it into like a 3-star establishment, you know, with all these rapists and murderers with towels over their arms and serving the fellow inmates and stuff like that, you know. So he takes over the jail thing, and then the whole premise of the novel is that they're all conspiring to do something to make him mad so he'll explode, hurt somebody, and he'll extend his time because they don't want to lose the food that they're having over the years. It's very complicated. So I was talking to Nelson DeMille about this, right? I said, I got this idea, and I'm going on and on and on and on and on. And I said, you know, Nelson, it just occurred to me, you're having a pretty good career without my help. You know, I don't think... He says, I don't know if it'll work as a novel. Maybe a screenplay. Try a screenplay, Tom. Okay, Nelson. Maybe I should just go back in the kitchen and cook. But anyway, that's my project for when I finally retire, you know, 30, 40 years from now. I'll work on my novel. I think it's a good idea.
Well, put it on the list.
Yeah, my bucket list. That and Tahiti. I want to go to Tahiti and I want to write a novel. Anyway, so, yeah, getting back to Paddy's Day, I mean, you know, all kinds of fun ways people have, I guess, developed now to celebrate the holiday, you know. I had a friend that used to, he had a bagel route when we were kids, you know. And I remember he had green bagels every St. Paddy's Day. Did you ever see those? You know, they had the green bagels for Paddy's Day. Green beer. I've seen people throw food coloring in beer and, you know, just do that Irish thing. Have you been to the parade, the St. Paddy's Day parade in the city?
I can't say that I have.
No, me either. No, I haven't. I kind of avoid those things like the plague. They're just too, what's the word I'm looking for? Drunk? I don't know. I'm trying to. I used to go to the Paddy's Day Parade in Montauk every year, you know, because I lived out there for a long time. And that was always fun, you know. But it always resulted in the same thing. All the bars were, you know, completely crowded after the parade, and people would. You know, nobody likes drinking, you know, wine or whatever more than I do. But at some point, you know, if the goal is just to get whacked and, you know, drive everybody nuts, I'm out, you know. So I would go home after the parade, obviously, and kind of avoid it like the plague. But they have a big one every year in Montauk. It's huge.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
but I'm confused because St. Patrick's Day parades are all over the place, meaning... It's not one day. Like, they've been going on for the past 4 weeks.
Yeah, no, you know, it's everybody when it's convenient. You know, the thing about parades that always perplexed me was, like, the first guy who figured this out said, I mean, all right, listen, dude, look, we're gonna walk down the middle of the street, all right? I want all you people to stay on the sidewalk, and I want you to watch, and then clap when we go by, you know? And I don't want you to join. I just want you to stand there and watch, and we'll go, and I'll get the fire. It's like, where did this start? You know, how did that – there had to be – Ground zero. There had to be parade number one, you know? And I'd be curious to find out where and when it happened. Because I'm not a parade watcher. I don't know. You know, I've seen a Macy's parade and, you know, all of that on TV. I was brought to the gay pride parade. I had a friend of mine who was worked for me for a while, a gay man. He was a waiter. And he dragged me to see the gay pride parade. So I did see that once. But other than that, you know, I don't know. I'm not a big parade. You go to parades at all?
I believe my parents took me to the Thanksgiving Day parade when I was real young. I was able to provide to carry about 10 years ago at this point. I have a friend that has an apartment right by Central Park South.
Mm-hmm.
And I always would joke with him, you know, could hang out there.
Look out the window, you know.
And he goes, yeah. So it was a whole involved thing. I had to go into the city first to get the key. You know, that was the beginning of the week. Get it from the doorman, got the key. And then I actually wasn't able to go, but I provided the opportunity for Carrie. And she wanted to take the kids to see the blowing up of the balloons and stuff. And that, I guess, is on Central Park North. Central Park West, I guess. Down by the museums or whatever. And, you know, November's tricky weather.
Oh, yeah.
So I believe, I guess it was like the Thursday night or the Friday night, it wasn't all that nice. It was cold. But they went. They did their walk or whatever. And the idea was that they were going to go out on the street and watch the parade. But they got lazy. And as it turned out, the parade literally walked in front of the apartment.
Oh,
and
yeah?
They were like on the third or fourth floor. And it was like a TV screen.
Yeah, well, you're right. Eye level with the floats, right?
It was supposedly crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they had the best time. That they sat there in their pajamas, you know, watching the parade walk by.
Uh-huh.
And it's priceless. I mean, I've heard stories where families have, there's a hotel, a Hilton or something, maybe on Broadway. Because
uh-huh.
I guess after it comes off Central Park South, it comes down Broadway, I'm
right.
led to believe.
Right.
But people make a reservation, and you can't even book it for the day. You got to do like a 3-night stay or something. They got it all, you know, to make sure there's some money there.
Yeah.
But again, so the Thanksgiving Day parade is always great. I was in the Columbus Day parade.
Were you?
Years and years ago, when my other life, I was in the manufacturing business.
Uh-huh.
And I guess somebody we worked with was like the president of the Columbus Society or something. And they...
Oh, the Knights of Columbus?
Not Knights of Columbus. Yeah. It was some Italian organization. And the New York Athletic Club or something, again, was like on Central Park South or something. And they were the ones that ran the parade. And they said, hey, do you want to come? And it was like in 1981. The only reason I remember is my wife at the time was pregnant. She was, I guess October is the parade, the Columbus Day parade, and she was due in November.
Mm-hmm.
And her sister were both due. And we got to sit in the reviewing stands.
Oh, really?
But, you know, to get there, we had these two pregnant women in the eighth month waddling across yeah. the street or
in
whatever.
In a great mood.
Yeah, yeah. But it was actually pretty cool. you know, I heard the real crazy parade is the Halloween parade down in the village.
The village, yeah, that's nuts. Yeah, that's nuts. The only one, what's going on here this morning? I remember as a kid, you know, Little League, and you used to march in the parades when you were children, you know. And the Memorial Day parade was always the one that we got involved in because, you know, there was the big one in Carl Place when I was a kid in Little Leagues where, you know, all the teams, you get dressed up in your uniform and march. But there's something about the Memorial Day parades, you know, I got a soft spot for people who've sacrificed like that, you know, especially ones who never came back. So, you know, that was always poignant for me. And even as a kid, it was, you know, the whole spirit of it was never lost on me. I really had a kind of it had deep meaning for me, actually, as a kid, because, you know, I had a lot of family members that served in the armed forces. And, you know, as an adult, you know, I lost a cousin who was on the Forrestal, that battleship that blew up over in the Gulf of Tonkin. And we had a couple of guys from Carl Place High School that were killed in Vietnam. So it was, you know, I never lost sight of the fact that some people make the ultimate sacrifice, obviously. And, you know, we've moved so far away from that. I don't know if that's meaningful to kids anymore. You know, they just taught different stuff now. It's just, it's sad. It's all going away, you know. Anyway, let's take a little break and we'll come back and maybe we'll talk about some food.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shordell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yeah, so talking about food, because we do that occasionally here on Playing with Fire, I was to a restaurant the other night. I'm going to give you one of my experiences, and I won't mention the name of the place. And it's a place I've been to frequently. You know, love the vibe, like the place, you know, the whole thing. And so go there, and they have foie gras on the menu. And I'm kind of a sucker for it, you know, because it's kind of fading out as a thing, you know. As there's politics involved, there's, you know, fat content involved, there's, you know, all the other stuff that PETA, you know, people, animal rights activists. It's gotten to be this, you know, political thing. And I think one of the only reasons it's political is because it's really kind of, you know, it's an eat the rich thing. It's kind of a food that, you know, I don't think the pigs and the chickens are treated any better, and nobody's outlawing chicken because, you know, it's the food of the masses. So that aside, anyway, so foie gras on the menu, right? And so, yeah, I'm going to have order that foie gras. Okay, cool. So it came with this cranberry thing and on a piece of toast or whatever. Really nice sized portion of foie gras. I'm getting all ready to get in there. And I take a bite, and it's not cold. It's icy cold, almost like
frozen.
It's right, yeah, like it was frozen and it wasn't really completely thawed out. And I thought it was the cranberry relish that was on it. So I'm thinking, wow, the cranberry is really cold. And I tasted the cranberry, and the cranberry wasn't that cold. I tasted a piece of foie gras by itself, and it was icy cold, right?
See, that's really interesting because many times at high-end steak restaurants, when you get a dessert and you get the cheesecake, a lot of times it will actually come out frozen.
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty good indicator where to get a cheesecake from. But this is different.
In this situation,
this is seared, you know, seared on.
Well, I was just going to say, usually it's not hot, but isn't it usually come out like warm?
Yeah, because it's warm through. I mean, you want it like medium rare in the middle, but it comes out warm through, right? So, it's a young kid right behind there, and there's an open kitchen. You're sitting right there. It's like a food bar, and a young kid comes over. How's everything, sir? I said, well, I said the foie gras is like ice cold, you know. He goes, really? I said, yeah, it's not just chilly, it's ice cold, you know. So I see him walk over to the chef, you know, who's cooking there. And they're whispering back and forth, and, you know. And the guy's back is to me, right? And he's no further. He's 5 feet away from me, 6 feet away from me, the cook, right, chef, whatever. And nothing, you know. So he doesn't acknowledge it, whatever. They go back to whatever they're doing. I push the foie gras to the side. I didn't eat it, you know. And that was that, right? So I'm thinking he's going to, you know, come over and grab it and reheat it or give me another piece or something. But nothing ever happened. And you know, it's $30. And it's not that $30 is going to change my life. But, you know, it's the principle of the thing. You know, when I get this thing, I'm not eating it. I've already complained and nothing happened. And so I get the bill, and it's on the bill, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, I pay the bill and I leave. And I was saying to Val, I'm like, I'm thinking about calling the owner because I know the owner, you know, and telling him, because I would want to know if it was me. And not to chastise the kid, but just to train him a little bit and say, listen, you get a thing like that, you got to fix it. You know, you got to make it right. You got to, like, you know, I'll take it back. I'll give you another piece, or would you like something else instead, or, you know, that kind of thing. But to, you know, to not do anything. And it's probably not the kid's fault. He was 21 years old or whatever, you know. But I'm thinking, and I haven't done it yet. I'm still going to do it. I'll probably do it when I leave here. Now that I'm thinking about it, I got to call the owner and tell him. And it's happened to me before in different places. I was in a place in Oceanside once, and I sat at the bar. And I came in. It was an L-shaped bar, and I sat at the small part of the L, facing, like, down the bar. And the bartender was there, and she was setting up whatever she was setting up, and she's cleaning a glass. And I literally sat there. And I got to the point where I said, I'm just going to, because at the time, my girlfriend said, let's go, let's get out of here. Nobody's acknowledging us. And I said, like, I want to see how long this takes.
Is that the Parisian place that was in Oceanside?
No. But so I sat there 17 minutes. And the bartender was 20 feet away from me. Never acknowledged our presence. So we got up and left. And then I called the owner. And I said, listen, I'm only doing this because I think I'm doing you a favor. You know, I would want this phone call if it was me. And I know it's painful to hear, but this is what happened. And he goes, you know, thank you so much. He knew who I was, right? I said, thank you so much for, you know, telling me. I appreciated the whole thing. I said, yeah, you know, listen, better it happened to me, because I'm not going to go out and tell everybody what a, you know, a bad place you have there. I just know it's human error, and, you know, we're all at the mercy of our employees. But I think in this recent thing, I think I have to call him and let him know, because A, one, I know him, B, it's a good place. He's got a good restaurant there, and he needs to know what happened. He wasn't there that night. It wouldn't have happened if he was there, I'm sure, you know.
So you're talking about foie gras?
Oh, but, you know, one second, hold the thought. And what I was trying to get to is, here's a great example of, you know, I'm not going to go home and rip the place on Yelp and tell 72,000 of my friends not to go there and, you know, the Tri-State restaurant or whatever, and complain about, you know, how bad the service was. This is, let's fix it. You know, if you're really interested in fixing a problem, you either complain at the time when somebody can fix it, or you go back to the owner on another day and say, listen, I just want to tell you what happened here so it doesn't happen again, rather than thinking you're so important that you're going to influence 50,000 people not to go to the restaurant ever. And that's my speech.
There you go.
Yeah.
So tell me if this is sacrilegious, but you're talking about foie gras, and I've been into burgers lately.
Yeah.
What about a burger topped with some foie gras?
Yeah, you're 10 years too late. Yeah, Daniel Ballou did that. He actually stuffed foie gras inside a burger, which was an interesting fact, because, you can't have it too rare, because then the foie gras is raw, you know, so it's tricky, you know. But I've put foie gras on burgers. I put foie gras on French toast. You know, not that anybody ever ordered it, but
do you ever do cheeseburgers?
Yeah.
What's your choice on cheese?
If I'm eating it or if I'm selling it?
Eating it.
I like cheddar. And I like Swiss. American cheese to me is, you know, most of it's made by 3M Plastic Company or whatever.
Well, that's funny you say that. I get a kick out of, lack of a better term, supermarket sliced cheese.
Oh, God.
And they come in the individual slices. That's like manufactured.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah.
A little better is when you get a package of cheese and it's, you know, sliced, but it's,
yeah,
it's like 20 slices in a thing.
Yeah.
But to me, and it's probably no different, but when you get it freshly sliced at the deli or whatever, you know, that tastes like cheese or whatever. Again, I've been into burgers lately. So went to a pubish type place in Huntington. I usually, at a pub, I just usually disappoint myself. I guess I'm not a big pub food type guy.
Yeah.
So I figured I'm going to be safe. I'll get a burger. And what intrigued me was it was on a pretzel roll.
Uh-huh.
But I was disappointed. What, in your mind, should a roll be firm? Should it be soft? I'm all confused.
Yeah, see, when it comes to burgers, when I had Cool Fish, we did a lot of lunches over there, right? And I tend to serve my burgers personally, excuse me, on English muffins.
You
That's my
that.
Preferred thing. Hmm. But if I'm going to do a burger roll like I do over at the club, I use a potato roll, which is nice and soft.
So that's interesting. So,
I think
yes.
The problem with a pretzel roll is you bite it, the roll is hard, the burger goes flying out the other side. You know what I mean? It's like terrible.
No. So you just nailed it. So I'm the guy that likes a softer roll.
Yeah.
Like if I go to a Peter Luger's or whatever, mm-hmm. and their rolls, I love their onion roll that's right there. It's got a nice consistency. It's great. Again, going to the burger. So I was all psyched, you know, I was going to get this pretzel roll.
Yeah.
And again, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe pretzel rolls are usually firm like a pretzel. I don't know. But yet, I guess a lot
They're
of times
denser.
Pretzels are soft.
Yeah, but the pretzel roll is denser than this.
So my go-to, if I'm barbecuing or I'm going to do burgers, is the potato roll.
Yeah.
I've been intrigued because there's all of a sudden that Hawaiian rolls, whatever those are.
Yeah, you can't do without them.
Yeah, they're like sweet or something, whatever.
Yeah.
But now, instead of just being dinner rolls, now they make slider rolls and that roll. I'm intrigued to try that. But as a guy living single, my problem is I'll go and buy a package of burgers, mm-hmm. you know. And unfortunately, if I buy it fresh, it ends up getting frozen because
sure, yeah, yeah.
you know, otherwise I got to eat.
Yeah, you got to eat 12 of them.
Yeah. But my problem is the burgers can be saved. If I buy a package of rolls.
Yeah, you're dead.
Well, it doesn't work because, no, you know, bread, next you know. Thing I know, a week later I go and they're green.
Out. Yeah, of course.
But that's the other thing I want to ask.
Use them for Patty's Day.
Most of the time, burgers are sold as fours or sixes,
mm-hmm.
the patties.
Are they, yeah.
But the rolls come as eights.
Yeah. Well, it's a problem. It's a it's a division problem. You have to do long division. If you can still do
What's
long division,
What's the LCD,
you're fine.
The least common denominator?
Yeah, exactly, you know. No, the reason that I think about this stuff a lot more than the average cat, right? So if I'm going to serve a burger, what's going to happen with the burger? So I'm sitting there at home having a glass of wine thinking about the burger, and I'm like, okay, you're going to have to, you got to bite the burger. I don't want it shooting out the other side like some deli sandwiches that my friend makes that makes me crazy. So what does that mean? That means I want a softer roll. And why would I want a softer roll? Well, for two reasons. One, it's easier to bite through and get all the stuff that you have in here. And two, and most importantly, it absorbs the juices from the burger.
Yes.
And that's the key. You don't lose it. It's not running down your arm. It's not on a plate.
So going through that, that's another thing. So if you put ketchup on a hamburger or mustard or whatever or people
both.
Do. What? Or both.
That's my favorite.
I do both.
Yeah, me too.
And I think I did that even before.
I did too, way back.
obviously there's the... If you get a burger that's seasoned right, just the meat has a exquisite taste.
Yeah.
So are you doing the wrong thing by putting ketchup and mustard on it? Or
no, I think that's, you know, we refer to ketchup as sauce americaine, you know, because that's what goes with burgers. You know?
And if I'm correct, you're not a big fan of raw onions.
No.
But that's obviously a lot of people who raw onion on. But to me, a lot of times... And I'm not sure that you really appreciate it, but like the steak sauce that's at the most of the high-end steak restaurants, the Peter Luger sauce or whatever.
Yeah, I make my own.
I like that on a burger. That sweet, sweet, tangy taste. But a really good burger, for me, has to have a nice slice of tomato on it.
Mm-hmm.
But not that cardboard deli slice.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, most people just, you know, get a bad one. And, you know.
And do you think lettuce does anything for a burger?
Yeah, I think it gives you a little roughage, you know, I mean, as far as digestion goes. But I don't think it does anything. I think that, you know, if you look at some of these, you know, burgers that people build, yeah, there's nothing wrong with lettuce and tomato. I think that the onion thing to me, this is the I think the biggest problem with burgers is the raw onion. I mean, I don't think that... You know, anybody would take an onion, peel it, and then eat it like an apple. So why would you, in my thought process, why would you put that on a burger? You know, now, if you would take an onion, you saute it down, you bring out the sugars, you cut some of the sharpness of it, you know, you cut that out. That's totally acceptable. So I tend to, excuse me, when I make burgers or eat them, you know, if there's sautéed onions available, I think that's fun on there. You can mix it with a little bordelaise sauce. That's always great. They have like a creamy sautéed onion on there. You can do that. I also think that, you know, the bacon, you know, a lot of people have bacon burgers or whatever. I tend to make a bacon and onion jam with some dark balsamic vinegar and some brown sugar in there and, you know, place that on the burger. And I think there's way more flavor in that. And you don't have the sharpness that you have on a typical raw onion kind of thing. And when you bite into the raw onion, and it's, you know, you're going to carry it with you for the rest of the day. You know, they stink to high heaven. So I just think it's kind of a, you know, it's, what's the word I'm looking for? There's a laziness to it for me as far as the kitchen goes. You know, you just slice it and put it on there. And somehow it took. I mean, I'm probably in the minority. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people that like, you know, raw onions, and that's fine. But I just tend to think the other way. And, you know, I see it when, because, you know, we sell them like that in the club because, and that's what's expected in the country club. I don't use raw onion in the restaurants, but in the country club we do. And I see how much of it comes back and gets thrown away. Very few people really eat them. You know, it's a nice little, you know, garnish confection there. It looks nice, and you know, color combination with red onion, whatever. But I don't think it's I don't think it's really necessary. And I think if you want raw onion, you can sort of request it. I would rather have sautéed onions or an onion jam or something like that, or no onion at all. I mean, and people are starting to top burgers with all kinds of stuff now. I mean, you know, farm eggs and you know, different sauces. This year I started screwing around with a smash burger, which is kind of fun, actually. And it's seasoned meat. You know, we season it pretty well. It's not just, you know, salt and pepper. You use Worcestershire in there, a little mustard and whatever. I won't tell you the rest. It doesn't matter. But, you know, you make a little ball and you put it on a grill and smash it down with a, you know, a weight or something. And, you know, cooks all the way through. But, you know, we got some, I make this little smoked tomato remoulade we call comeback sauce. And, you know, put that on it with a dill pickle. And there's a lot of flavor going on there, which is kind of fun. It's not just your regular burger with ketchup. So I think that the variations that people come up with now with hamburgers are kind of brilliant. And you know what? I watch Food Channel a lot, and I watch the Cooking Channel a lot, obviously, because I'm interested in AB. It passes the time for me at night when I get home. But when you watch Guy Fieri's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, they have an awful lot of these places that serve burgers, and some of it's contrived and silly. But there's a lot of imagination going on. You know, you watch people build these burgers with avocado or they'll do. I saw a guy do a Tuscan style burger once with, he had this tomato-y sort of sauce for it. And he had melted truffle pecorino cheese on top, which was really kind of cool. And I've seen Mexican burgers, you know, with pico de gallo and avocado and some cotija cheese and things like that. So, you know, if you're out there on your barbecue, we're getting to barbecue season. If you're cooking outside and you're going to do some burgers, you know, you can use your imagination there and have some fun with it rather than just, doing a hamburger ketchup and pickle thing. I think that, the ingredients list, if you walk through, your supermarket vegetable aisle there, you'll see all kinds of fun stuff to play with. You can roast peppers down and put peppers on the burger. There's all kinds of lettuces you can substitute and vegetables that you can grill alongside. And instead of maybe the usual coleslaw, you know, you buy at a deli, you can find some zucchini and some yellow squash and some peppers and grill those and make a nice little grilled vegetable salad to serve on the side of the burger rather than, you know, the potato salad or whatever. But, I think that, you know, even something as simple as the humble hamburger, which is probably one of the most popular dishes, I would think, in the United States, there's all kinds of ways to elevate it to something that's really special. And I think that, you know, trying those things, you know, is part of the fun of cooking. You know, it's, you know, cooking, if you have an imagination and an affinity for it, I think is one of the purest and most interesting art forms there are out there. If it's just utilitarian, like you're doing, I got to cook again for the, you know, it's not fun. It's drudgery. It's not easy. You know, it's labor intensive and it's work, you know, but if you enjoy it, it's a whole different story. And I was lucky. I got bit by the bug early on and it's been my life's pursuit, you know, for the last 50 something years. So I always like, to take, you know, something like the humble hamburger and do something imaginative with it and not just, you know, do the, like Stu and I just said, you know, we both like ketchup and mustard on a hamburger. I eat maybe four hamburgers a year. I don't eat them much, you know. But when I do, you know, I was just talking about the Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives thing where, you know, you have all this imagination going on and they're fun. You watch, you get these ideas. You know, if you're into cooking, there's a million ways to expand your horizons. Like I watch, you know, when I'm home, I rarely watch TV other than, you know, Netflix. Maybe I'll get into a documentary or something that's interesting. But I watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives on the Cooking Channel, and I garner ideas from them, believe it or not. I have 600 cookbooks home. I garner ideas there. I read periodicals. So there's a million ways. There's so much information out there now. It's almost overload. The internet, you know, any recipe you want is on the internet. But to be able to take humble things. Again, not to beat a dead hamburger. Take humble things like a hamburger and elevate it into something really interesting. I think it's just a very cool thing to do, you know? And why not? Why just leave it at ketchup and mustard, you know?
Gotcha. So many times when I get a burger, I don't even use the top of the roll because I sort of plate it and then just cut it up and eat it like a steak. But it's with the lettuce, the tomato, the whatever.
Yeah, I don't think lettuce does much other than, you know, kind of hold the tomato in place, really. I mean, you know, what are you going to do with the lettuce? And I think it's a garnish that's colorful on the
plate.
But
what's funny is what bothers me with the, again, talking about that slice of tomato that, again, To me, a beefsteak tomato, a nice slice on there or whatever. And you go to the fast food restaurant to get a burger, and it's just to put something in your stomach because it's growling.
Yeah.
But they give you that cardboard slice of tomato. It's like...
It's terrible. I mean, I'm lucky enough now in the business. I can get heirloom tomatoes all year round now, right? So it's not just the... You know, the local tomatoes I prefer to use in the summer from July to September. But there are some heirlooms around that are decent, you know, year-round. They bring them up from Chile or the South somewhere or whatever. Anyway, I prefer to use them on a burger. I think if you're going to, you know, my goal is to put the best ingredients on the plate that I possibly can,
mm-hmm.
regardless of where they come from. I mean, I tend to support the local homies as best I can. But, you know, I'm not going to garnish the plate with, you know, I'm not putting cauliflower on a burger in December because that's what you get around here, right? So I'll get these heirloom tomatoes, and I prefer to use them, and I think it makes a difference. You know, like you said, who wants a little, you know, store-bought Roma tomato that has absolutely no flavor, really, you know what I mean? And it's just, at that point, it's just red on the burger and some, I guess, nutrition or whatever.
Let me ask you this. When you the traditional pairing of a burger is with French fries. I'm finding today
I pair it with Pinot Noir, personally.
Well, that, of course.
Yeah.
But I find that a lot of restaurants these days are using seasoned fries.
Mm.
And I don't know. To me, the perfect French fry is is a properly prepared Nathan's fry,
yeah,
with a little bit of salt. It is wonderful, and then you end up with some of the little crisp stuff in your container.
Yeah.
But I'm not a big fan of these seasoned potatoes or whatever.
No, it's each his own. I mean, you know, I've done the truffle parmesan thing because people ask for
yes,
it.
Yes, that's
not my thing. I mean, truffle oil is, you know, it's fine, but it's chemically altered. It's not.
Then
real
you
truffle.
Got a lot of the a lot of people offering sweet potato fries and stuff.
Yeah, they're cool. I mean, and supposedly better for you, I guess, you know. I like sweet potato fries. I mean, they're fine. I think there's a potato out there called Kennebec, and it comes from Maine, I believe. And that's the best French fry potato I've ever had. And there's a place in Portland called Duck Fat. That's the name of the restaurant. And it's basically a lunch place. They do a lot of, not burgers, they do sandwiches. Interesting sandwiches, soups, you know. And they got fries with a whole bunch of dips. You know, you can get like, I think they have 7 or 8 different dips you can dip the fry in, you know. But they use only Kennebec potatoes, and they use only duck fat to fry them in. And, baby, it makes a difference, you know. It's they're the best French fries I've ever had. You should check it out if you're ever in Portland. It's a long way to go for an order of French fries, I get it. But if you happen to be there, you know, don't miss it.
So we're talking about burgers, and it's just Academy Awards season, and there's been a lot of talk about In-N-Out burgers.
Oh, yeah?
I guess, I know there's one in Vegas. I didn't realize, I guess it's a California thing.
Yeah, it's a Los Angeles thing, I think.
But somehow, at some of the parties, they had In-N-Out burger. But they were talking about when you go to get your burger at the restaurant, they ask you if you're eating in or eating out, and they give it to you in like almost like a plate container.
Because oh, yeah.
If you're driving, it's I guess it's known to trip all over the place.
Yeah, it's a 5 napkin burger, it's a 5 guys or whatever.
But it seems like everybody talks about it, but it was just amazing this year with the Academy Awards. It just kept on all the different news reports and stuff. Somehow it was involved.
You know, I could watch the Academy. I don't, but I could watch the Academy Awards if they would talk about food and hamburgers instead of politics and stuff
you,
like they
you
know
would
anything
a,
they're talking
you would
about.
Get a kick out of it. This is a quick, funny story. Mammoth WVH played the Paramount recently, and that band is actually
Wolfgang Van Halen, right?
Yes. Yeah. So they performed at the Paramount last week, and we had Wolfie. Down to the studio, and he had a great interview with Rob Rush, mm-hmm. Our friend. And the opening act was Nita Strauss,
who's a
guitar phenom.
She's great. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
She played with Alice Cooper.
Yes, I've seen her play with Alice Cooper, and that's where I learned about her. And then I guess she played in Brooklyn recently, and she partnered with the radio station to promote the gig, and then she was opening up. So
and you didn't call me.
I apologize.
You should.
So but that will lead to another story. But at any rate, so Nita was at the Paramount also. She did her solo thing, incredible. But Rob told us in confidence. I can't really talk about it, but Wolfie told me that he's going to be at the Academy Awards, and sure enough, Ryan Gosling did the Ken song.
Oh yeah.
And he came out in a pink tuxedo, I'm Ken or whatever, and it was with Slash and Wolfie up there playing guitar.
Oh wow.
So it was like this Gentlemen's Prefer Blonde type of routine. Instead of Marilyn Monroe, it was Ryan Gosling as Ken.
Yeah.
And then you got Slash with his top hat, you know, hitting the strings and Wolfie up there. So it was pretty cool. Real quick, the next couple of days later, I got to see Bachman Turner Overdrive,
wow.
Which was, I guess, late 70s, 80s.
I saw them
rock band.
In the 70s.
So,
Coliseum.
Real quick, the Tiller Center, they had the Guess Who last year. And I look, and it's all young guys playing with the band. The Guess Who was from the 70s also. And the drummer is the only guy that's there from the band, which is ridiculous because it's like
Randy
a cover
Bachman
band.
Used to play
right.
in it.
So Randy Bachman is part of Bachman Turner Overdrive at Westbury Friday night, sold out show. And I got to three concerts in one because Randy was the lead singer of the Guess Who.
Yeah.
He played a half a dozen Guess Who songs. They played Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Uh-huh.
His son, Ty Bachman, had a hit in the 80s. He played his song. So now you got like three concerts. And then they did a rock and roll medley that had anything from Shook You All Night Long, All Right Now.
Oh,
it was incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
What a great show.
Oh, cool.
But whatever. I just have to share that
enthusiasm
with you guys.
Yeah, they're fun to see, man. You know, some of those older bands, they can go. I mean, you know, listen, Wolfgang Puck has turned into a great little guitar player.
Wolfgang Van Halen.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that genetic, you know, predisposition. I mean, his father
he didn't have much of a stage presence. he can perform,
yeah,
but he didn't really have the stage performance. But he seems to have a following, and obviously the bloodline is going to keep him moving forward.
There's probably a nostalgic part of
that. But the place was packed. Again, it was a great night, and more power to you again.
Yeah, you know, he's living in a big shadow. I mean, Eddie changed the way people thought about guitar. You know, nobody played like him. You know, I mean, there's guys that are as good, but he was a big innovator. And, you know, I remember when that first Van Halen album came out, it was like, whoa, holy, you know what, man, this is nuts, you know. And he had that kind of effect on everybody who played the guitar after that. You know, it was, he changed the way the world thought about guitar playing, which is not easy to do. And so Wolf's got, you know, he's got that thing. I mean, his mom's Valerie Bertinelli, and I mean, she, you know, she's a star in her own right, you know. So he's got a lot to deal with, and I think he's dealt with it with a lot of class and aplomb, and he's put his nose to the grindstone and became a really talented musician, you know. And it's hard when your dad's that good, you know. I mean, you always, you know, how do you live up to that? But he's doing a good job, you know. It's like Dweezil Zappa, the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, Dweezil's a great guitar player, you know, and he honors his father, but he's not trying to be his dad, which is kind of cool, you know. Those guys, I feel for them because they have this thing to look up to that's almost impossible to imitate. On that note, we have to go.
Wow.
It's that time, Stu, so we'll close the show with Tom's Three Keys to Life as normal, as normal as I can be anyway. Tom's Three Keys to Life are: life is too short to drink bad wine, treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza.
And save some room for a grand plate of corned beef and cabbage today.
All right, top of the morning
with a beer, with a brew.
And happy St. Patty's Day.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.